Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome to Eat Your Heartland Out. I'm your host, Capri Cafaro. This week, the show highlights two individuals who have received one of the most coveted awards in the culinary world, the James Beard Foundation Award. Damar Brown is the chef de cuisine at Vertu, a restaurant on Chicago's South Side. A former contestant on Top Chef, Damar Brown earned the 2023 Emerging Chef Award from the James Beard Foundation. Damar will join me later in the program. It's a conversation you won't want to miss. But right now, I want to welcome another James Beard Award recipient who calls the Midwest home. Marissa Gencarelli moved from Mexico to Kansas City 18 years ago and decided to bring a taste of her home country to her new hometown by making tortillas. Now, Yoli Tortilleria has been named the 2023 Outstanding Bakery by the James Beard Foundation. Marissa, we are excited to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start at the beginning. You started this tortilleria, but you're based in Kansas City, but Kansas City is not your birthplace. So tell us how you got to the Midwest and ultimately how you decided to start this business.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I'm from Sonora, Mexico. So for those who are not familiar with the geography of that, that's south of the border from Arizona. My hometown is called Ciudad Obregón, which is really right by the Gulf of California inland. And so we have one side, beautiful ocean, and the other side, we have the Copper Mountains. So it's a beautiful, beautiful place to grow up. Very idyllic.
It sounds gorgeous.
Yes, it's absolutely stunning. My hometown in particular is a valley, so grows lots of different things. It was wonderful. And then, unfortunately, the reason that I ended up in the States, it was more that my parents had passed when I was 20 and 21. So I lost both of them within a 2-year span.
Oh, goodness.
And, I was just trying to figure out what to do. And my mom, thankfully, had left me a home in Tucson. That's where my mom's family's from, Arizona and California area. And I decided to just take a leap of faith and just start all over in Arizona.
How did you make the journey from Tucson to Kansas City?
Yeah, so that's where I'm next. So I ended up studying abroad in Italy, and I met my future husband and also Yoli co-founder. And he's come from Kansas City. And so that's kind of how I ended up in here. You know, it's just graduated from college and then trying to figure out what to do. And we decided to get hitched and we moved to Kansas City.
That's fantastic. You've had, quite a bit of different life experiences. And, it sounds like at least thus far in the story that, a culinary background isn't necessarily, your main, career focus, at least up to this point. So
absolutely not.
At what point, because I think, you kind of stayed from the conversation we had initially had, if I recall correctly, you kind of had, you stayed in the corporate world for a while and then decided to take a turn into the culinary world. Is that right?
That is correct. So yeah, I'm living my second stage of life, I guess. So I did a corporate. Once I moved to Kansas City, I got recruited by a very large healthcare company here. So for a while, I gosh, I probably traveled over 32 countries where we were assessing their technologies, their governments, initiatives. I worked with all kinds of different people, and it was just a fantastic experience. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was still corporate, and it was, you know, very hard work. And I remember being pregnant with my second child and coming back from Norway, like, so tired. You know, I would wake up in a country not even knowing what country it was. And so it was just really exhausting. And so I was like, something has to change, you know. And so that's kind of how I just started cooking. And then I would visit my family in Mexico. And of course, you know, like, they're very, you know, Mexican, like, oh, mijita, how are you? And why you're not eating enough, or, you know, whatever it was. And right. They would, you know, we would fill up our suitcases with tortillas. And I had my aunt gave me a recipe cookbook. And so, like, literally that would become my detox when I would come back from a long corporate day. And so, yeah, it was really more of like, what can I do that I am not on my phone and I'm not hearing the pings of the emails, you know? So it's like, and if when you're cooking, if you're not paying attention, you're going to burn something. So, yep. So it worked really well for me.
Well, you know, a lot of people find solace in the kitchen, you know, particularly, you know, in high stress jobs like you're describing, that it gives people a sense of grounding, of, you know, a break of normalcy from this, you know, the kind of crazy, you know, daily grind and travel and all the rest of the things that you know, you've talked about. I'm curious to know, you know, you were talking about how your aunt gave you, a recipe book. Did you grow up, you know, with your family making the tortillas the way that, you know, you make them now?
No. And that's something really funny. I tell everybody, it's like, no, I didn't grow up making the tortillas. You have tortillerias everywhere in Mexico. So it's like, you know, every other corner, boom, there's a tortilleria. And, you know, and they all have a different spin on it, meaning, especially with flour in Sonora, you know, so is it thicker, thinner, what kind of fat they're using, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so I would just, you know, walk to the tortilleria, get my tortillas for that day. Same for the nixtamalization. Nixtamalization is a lot of hard work. And so, yeah, you don't do it. You buy the fresh masa, bring it home, and then you might make your tortillas.
Can you talk about that, the nixtamalization? That's something that is a term that folks might not be familiar with. So maybe you can give a little bit of description of what that is.
Yes, with corn tortillas, what you do is you get dent corn, so whole dent corn, and you combine it with water and alkaline solution. Typically, it's lime, or it could be wood ash, and you bring it to a certain temperature. And then once that temperature is reached, you turn that heat off and then you let it soak. And what will happen is it's going to have a chemical reaction where the outer layer of the corn is going to get almost like a jelly. And, mm-hmm. and as you're rinsing it in the next day, it starts dissolving. And that's the best thing, because obviously that's a part of the corn of dent corn that is not very digestible for humans. And also what the lime reaction does with the corn is also the corn absorbs a lot of minerals. And so it makes the corn very healthy for you. So, so the process overall of nixtamalization is this reaction. So the next day you come in, you rinse that corn, and then you have volcanic stones where you grind the corn into the masa and make it into tortillas.
It sounds like a pretty labor-intensive process. Now, is that what you do for the tortillas you make now? You had to start from someplace, because if you didn't do this growing up, it sounds like were learning while you were kind of messing around in the kitchen later in life. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, and that's exactly the process we do. And you know, it has really started as like, hey, how can I get a better tortilla here? And we first got a little tiny grinder, one of those little crank ones, and that we could never get the texture right. Also, it's like, as you can imagine, the labor of doing that to get the masa soft, it was just crazy. And so then we would have like a different setup. You would do one pass and like the cuisine art, another one in the blender, and then another one in the final grinder. And, you know, and then you end up with gummy masa. And so it's like, yeah, so it is a lot of labor intensive, you know, type of initiative. And then, so yeah, that's how we started looking for actual real mills. And so that's really what spurred out the business. We were like, okay, well, let's get a real mill. What does that look like? And you know, what? How much does it cost? And could we do this as a side gig?
Mm-hmm. What made you think, you know what, like, I want to do this as a side gig? Because it's one thing to do it for yourself, to do it for your family, to say, you know, I want a taste of home. It's a whole other thing to say, you know what, I want to try to turn this into a business, even if it is, you know, a side hustle.
Yeah, you know, it was, well, for one, the expense of getting one of these things. You know, we were cashing out from our own money to buy this expensive machine.
Yep.
So might as well make something out of it. Really, that's what it came down to. You know, it's like, okay, well, if we're going to spend this much money, might as well do something on the side with it. And we seem to enjoy it. So why not?
Yeah. So where did you start to sell? When you started to kind of scale this operation, who were your customers?
So we were very focused on chefs. So, you know, when you're selling tortillas or bread, as you can imagine, it's a very low number that you have. So you have to sell a lot of them in order to make anything off of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started with restaurants, and we were very lucky. We have several chefs that embraced us. And yeah, I think that the first 6 months we only sold directly to restaurants. And then eventually we ended up in a farmer's market.
Mm-hmm. While you were still working, right? Full time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I mean, it was crazy. It was absolutely, I don't know. You know, I get a lot of questions from up and coming entrepreneurs. Should I quit my job or not? And I always say that's a personal question, and it really depends on where your finances are and how comfortable you are. In our case, Mark was the one who ended up quitting his corporate job. And so he was running the operations while I was, you know, working on my corporate job. And then after work, I would go ahead and hop and help him and, you know, start dropping samples to different restaurants and whatever it was needed to be done.
Yeah.
You know, I had the health insurance, so I couldn't quite quit yet.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I mean, these are, you know, real questions that people have to ask themselves. If, you know, side hustles sound great, but people like think more about sort of the glamour almost of, oh, we're going to have this, you know, cottage business and, you know, we're going to go to farmers markets. We're going to meet all these lovely people and, you know, share this, you know, artisan small batch fill in the blank. And you forget about the fact that you got to get up at 4 a.m. and, you know, you try and fail and you got to go and actually hustle and find, yep, you know, customers and all those things, which, you know, you really have to have that commitment. You know, I'm curious to know, you know, as you were going through this process and trying to, you know, chase that taste that, you know, you found authentic for your tortillas, how did you source ingredients in the Midwest, or did you get some imported or both?
You know, we started first with Midwest. I'm a strong believer of supporting your local economies. And so we were very lucky. We went to several farms right out here in Kansas City, literally 20 miles where we're currently located. The biggest challenge was a lot of people were growing beautiful corn, but it was not being cleaned and properly managed for human consumption. Most of that corn ends up going to feed.
Right.
So then we're trying to figure out, well, can we get a farmer that does like certain specific types of corn and does row cropping? And at the beginning, we couldn't get anyone right outside of Kansas City. So we ended up meeting a company right in Illinois. And they manage all organic and non-GMO heirloom corn varieties. And so I was like, I was pretty happy. They're close enough. And then as we got going, then we got approached by different farmers in the Kansas and Missouri community that said, you know, I think what you're doing is super cool. if I row X amount of corn, would you take it?
And oh, wow.
Like, and I was, and I always say like, well, yes, with the caveat that I hope it's good, you know, but I said, as long as you clean the corn properly and we can do all the tracking, obviously we're in some larger grocery stores and I need the proper tracking if case of an outbreak or anything.
Right. So you're in Whole Foods, right?
Yeah. So we need all the proper tracking, right? So it's like, as long as you do all that and I have everything tested and we are non-GMO certified, all these different things, as long as I have all the certifications in place, yes, of course I'll do it. And so currently we source from some farmers in Kansas, some in Missouri, and some in Illinois. We do import from time to time, and I have a very difficult, you know, existential question when you do that. There's many mm-hmm. reasons why. The first one is environmental impact. You know, shipping mm-hmm. all the way from Mexico, by the time you get it here, it might not be in its prime. Two, what impact is it having on the community? So you hear over and over a lot of stories about farmers in Mexico that this was their, you know, substance crop. So now they're left because they want to sell it to Americans or anyone else in the world for a higher price. And then they end up with nothing to feed their families, or they end up with the less than good corn. And so I kind of have a little bit of mixed, you know, feelings over that. You know, it's like, so I do source. There's one person that I source from that I trust that he is getting the, you know, the right pricing, and, you know, there's fair trade there. But I try to treat it at what it is, which is exceptional luxury to get it. And as such, I make sure that it's treated as a special batch.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, it makes total sense. I mean, it's wonderful to hear how committed you are to mission at every level of what you're doing with your business. And one thing that I recall again from, you know, when we had initially spoke is how you are trying to also educate consumers about the diverse culinary culture of Mexico. Tell me a little bit about, you know, how you're trying to help people better understand, you know, the regional cuisines of Mexico with what you're doing.
Yes, absolutely. So this comes really from, you know, from my childhood. As far as I can remember, I was 4 years old all the way until I was 12, and my brothers got too old and they didn't want to travel anymore. My parents used to like put us in a little Nissan Datsun, and we'd travel from the state of Sonora, which is up in the north side, all the way to the south. So literally 30 days of travel all throughout Mexico every year, every summer. And that really, you know, I always tell the story, as a child, it really scarred me, you know, from being in a car with no air conditioning and sweating with two older brothers fighting.
It's like a blast.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. At the time I was like, God, I hate these trips, you know. But now that I reflect back to it, I really cherish them because I didn't realize how much I was personally learning about how rich and diverse Mexico was from a cuisine and overall culture, you know, different indigenous peoples and different traditions, how different areas, you know, how the Spaniard influence happened, things like that, that most of the time you really don't think when you're eating a taco. And so when I started Yoli, one of the things that, you know, I wanted to share is how diverse Mexico is, you know? Yep. So it's like, you know, we get a taco in vogue, you know, when there's birria or whatever is in style, and that's all we think about. When in reality, you know, we have a vast cuisine that should be shared. And so I share how everything is different on every single region with my own products. So I will go ahead and say, if you come to our shop or you get any of our salsas, they will have a little bit of background of like where this salsa originates and how to probably pair it. So it's kind of like kind of giving you a little bit of hint without being too prescriptive. But I do mm-hmm. want you to know and understand that, hey, we're not, you know, all the same.
Right.
The other thing is we do write scenes.
I was just going to ask about that. I'm so glad you brought it up.
Yeah, yes. So we do zines. And the reason I did zines is obviously self-published. And, you know, there might be some, a couple curse words here and there on the zines. And basically, I focus on a single ingredient or a region. And so right now, we're in our second one, which it was all dedicated about masa. And it talks about, you know, hey, the political and socioeconomic implications of how masa came about and, you know, how it got mass produced and all the different waves and such. And now I'm working on my third one, which is all about the coffee culture. A lot of people don't realize that there's a big coffee culture in Mexico.
That's incredible. Now, do you write these yourselves? Or
so, yeah, it's a labor of love, but it's really about, it's meant to like share a little bit about a single ingredient.
You know, so as through our conversation here, we've gone from messing around in the kitchen to, you know, selling in farmers markets to restaurants to Whole Foods. And then you mentioned, oh, I have a shop. At what point did you establish a brick and mortar, you know, storefront?
Yeah, it was supposed to. So we started Yoli in 2017. The brick and mortar was to open in 2019. And unfortunately, we had a lot of issues with permits. It's kind of hard in KCMO to get a permit sometimes. And so anyways, long story short, you know, we're getting ready to get everything rolling in 2020. And we all know what happened in 2020.
Right.
But it was literally, we were already paying rent. And we're like, we are opening this thing. And so, yeah, we opened in the middle of the pandemic in the summer of 2020. And it was a small little tortilleria where we're doing all our flour tortillas from there. And then we used it as our R&D space. So we had all of the different products that Yoli makes. And, you know, we would have fun with it and experiment and see what people would think. And based on, you know, the success or the failure of it, the product stays or is gone. And so it became really pivotal for us. One, we could be directly interacting with our consumers, which we were used to in the farmers market, but now it just gave us a better stage to represent our product in a light that we wanted.
Mm-hmm. Now, so, you know, you just started the tortilleria in 2017, so 6 years ago. And, you know, people, and you just received a James Beard Foundation Award in the bakery category, correct?
Correct.
So in a matter of 6 years of establishing, you have already received one of the most prestigious awards in the culinary world. Tell me how that unfolded and how that made you feel.
You know, it's, you know, well, obviously we're incredibly honored and humbled by it. We were certainly not expecting, and in as you have heard from the rest of the episode, I do not come from the food world. So I first didn't even know what a James Beard was. You know, we were out there like, hey, can we like pay my mortgage? Can I quit my corporate job to do this full-time work kind of approach? So yeah, you know, the first time we got nominated, it was Mark and myself as actual bakers. And then the following year where we won, which is this year, is when they introduced more of a outstanding bakery category. So they kind of separated. Now they have like a pastry chef category and then a bakery category, which is great because, you know, if you make tortillas or if you're making, you know, any sort of buns or any other things other than just, you know, pastries, you're a bakery, right? So I think that is really great. And also it has a broader scope of like, what's your impact in the community, et cetera, et cetera. So the way that it worked, at least in our case, is that, you know, somebody randomly nominated us in their open call. And as we got vetted, then eventually we became semifinalists. And of course, it goes up to votes in the nationwide. And then, you know, we went and we won. We couldn't have been more shocked, honestly.
But how'd you find out? How'd you get that call or email or however you found out?
So like, when we were semifinalists, I was actually at home. It was a snow day in Kansas City. I'm with my kids. I wake up every day at 4 a.m. And, you know, I'm doing all my emails and everything. And then I'm feeding my kids breakfast. And one of my friends who was in France at the time sends me like a crazy text that, congratulations. And it's like, oh, she's confused.
You're like, for what?
For what? She must be confused. or what time is it in France? Is she drinking already? You know, that's really what I thought. And then I, you know, Google and start yelling, and that was about it. Then we just went on with our lives. It wasn't, you know, it was because it was so out of the blue for us for being nominated a second year in a row that we were really not expecting it. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when we get to be a finalist, again, we thought we had already hit the end of the road and it was cool and we have moved on, you know. And again, someone else called me and gives me this frantic message that we were watching live the stream where they're announcing. And I call Mark because I'm driving. And I said, like, can you validate that? Can you Google this? Because I'm driving and I can't see it. And yeah, it got validated. And it's like, yeah, it's just, you know, it's surreal. And, you know, we were incredibly excited. But then we keep our feet on the ground. And it's like, okay, that's cool. Got to move on. Got to work to do. You know, it's like, that's been our attitude. Because it's like, yeah, it's cool. But it's, you know, like we thought we had no chance.
So. Well, but you obviously did. You were nominated once. You were in your then you came back and won, you know, in 2023. And when people usually, you know, get a James Beard Foundation Award, it becomes almost like a marketing calling card in some way. Do you find that this award has impacted your business in any meaningful way where more people are, you know, trying to buy your product, more stores are trying to carry it, more restaurants are trying to, you know, use it in their dishes. Has it had that kind of, you know, monetary impact along with that prestige?
Oh, of course. It has a huge financial impact. The first month, I mean, our sales were up, you know, to the roof. In fact, that after we won, we're still in Chicago and, you know, 8 in the morning, our shop doesn't open until 10. There was a line around the block. You know, it was just crazy. And overnight, you know, you become recognizable to people not only in the United States, but across the world. What made our win a little bit different was that it was the impact as a tortilleria. It was the first time. Mm-hmm. A tortilleria had won, period. And, you know, Mexicans around the world really rallied about it. And it was just, honestly, it was, I don't even know how to explain it. It was just incredibly humbling. And you really understood that it wasn't just you winning, but it was our culture, you know, being an immigrant in the United States and then how it affects the rest of the world, because the rest of the world is watching what's happening in the culinary scene in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so it really just becomes a validation for tortillerias across the world that, you know, change is coming. And I mean change because for most part, everywhere receives a very manufactured tortilla full of preservatives and all that. Yep. And so now there's validation that there is a market for, you know, a good tortilla.
Absolutely. And what does this mean for your future now?
You know, we're still working towards the same plan that we were doing before the award, you know, and it's, we are really focused on how do we showcase the diversity of Mexican cuisine and what are those products that go along the way. And some of them, you know, I say products in quotation because it might be experiences. And so, again, for us, it's all about, hey, showcasing how different things could be. And so expansion of our product line is coming. We want to reach more grocery stores nationwide. And then we are, our shop in the West Side, we have actually converted it into a restaurant, which is opening late fall of this year.
Wow.
So it's a tiny little, you know, 10-seater. which, you know, it's, we're incredibly proud. It's going to feel like you're going one of those fondas in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually we're opening two other concepts rolling out in the next 2 years. But all of this was planned before winning. Just the winning just makes it a little bit more pressure on us to make sure that we execute it flawlessly, at least as good as possible.
Well, I have full faith in you and your operation to rise to the occasion. What an incredible journey, all done with purpose and care. Marissa Gencarelli from Kansas City, Yoli Tortilleria, James Beard Foundation Award winner 2023 in the bakery category. Marissa, thank you again for joining the program.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Don't go away. We have to pause for a break, but we'll be back with more from my conversation with Chef Damar Brown.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush, green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills, combined with the freshest milk available, created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old-world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
This is Eat Your Heartland Out, and I'm your host, Capri Cafaro, and we are celebrating award winners of the very prestigious James Beard Foundation Awards. There are a number that hail from the Midwest, including our next guest, and that is Chef Damar Brown. He is the chef de cuisine at Virtu in Chicago. Chef, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have quite a storied career, but it all has to start someplace. What got you interested in pursuing a life in the kitchen?
I think it was my family, actually. So I was raised by three women, my mother, my aunt, my grandmother. They were all phenomenal cooks. And I was the only child in the home. So I think as a means to keep me out of trouble, they would force me to cook with them. So I started, you know, peeling potatoes and snapping beans at a very young age. And it just so happens that I didn't mind it so much. And once they noticed that I was interested, they really leaned into it.
Yeah. How so?
You know, at that time, I think Food Network was becoming a thing. I really enjoy watching Emeril Live. He had this program where he, you know, be cooking 1 minute and be playing the drums next minute. He didn't get to the point that my mother, when Chopped kind of first came out, she would buy ingredients and challenge me to cook things with them. And, you know, I'd make something awful and she would give me very kind criticism. yeah, so from there, I started like doing church dinners and things like that. But I was, you know, physically cooking for people by the time I was 14, you know, groups of people. So, yeah.
Amazing. So this is all, this has been a lifelong passion for you and led you into getting formal training, right?
Yes. So right at the high school, of course, at that point, I knew I wanted to be a chef. So I applied to the Cooking Hospitality Institute of Chicago, which later became Le Cordon Bleu. And I started there at 18 and, yeah, I did the 2 year program. After that, I started working at MK Restaurant, which was just so happens a couple blocks away from the school. And I, you know, worked there for 7 years. I literally grew up in that restaurant.
Yeah. How'd you choose that particular restaurant to try to work at?
You know, honestly, I wanted to work for a chef that looked like me. And at that point in time, I didn't have many options. Marcus Samuelson had a restaurant called Sea House at that point in time. So I tried to get a stage there. For whatever reason, I, you know, couldn't get in. A friend suggested that I, you know, knock on the back door at MK. So I did. And I said all the things that underqualified cook would say. I said I worked for free. I'd wash dishes. I just wanted to, you know, be in the space. And they let me work for free. I started working in the mornings. And I started like that. Yeah, as an intern.
Amazing. Amazing. Now, so you, how long ago was this?
This was probably at the end of 2010. So almost 14 years ago, maybe. Yeah.
So as you know, you had just mentioned that, you know, at the time, so we're talking about over a decade ago at this point, there weren't a lot of chefs that looked like you, not a lot of folks, you know, that, you know, from the BIPOC community. Has that changed then? I mean, have you seen, you know, more people of color, you know, owning restaurants, running restaurants, being, you know, the chef that runs the show?
Absolutely. I think, you know, it's still a small percentage comparatively, but when you think about it, there are more, you know, people of color being recognized. And I guess what I should say that these people were always here is just that, you know, they're getting the attention that they probably have deserved for years now. Right. So now you can look in the country and cook any kind of food that you want to cook. You can go from Mashama or JJ or Kwame or, you know, in Chicago, we have Brian Jupiter, we have Darnell Reed, Cliff Rome. We have so many chefs of color doing so many wildly different things. And they've been doing these things for years, but now their names are being called out in different rooms and different media aspects, which is great to see.
And you are part of that too.
Yeah, I'm honored to you know, stand next to these individuals. Yes.
Well, it's well deserved. Now you've, you know, went, now you are at Virtue. How long have you been in your current position or at this current, at the current location?
It'll be 5 years in November.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What made you make that move?
You know, at the time I was working at Royster under Andrew Brochu as his sous chef, and I really feel like I grew a lot in that position. I really enjoy working at the restaurant, and I met a lot of beautiful individuals. But at a certain point, I figured out that Brochu was going to leave soon, and it just so happened that Chef Williams was going to open up Virtue. And I knew I wanted to be a part of it. So it was kind of like coming home.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about the restaurant and how you design your menus.
So Virtue is in the Hyde Park neighborhood, south side of Chicago. It is a very diverse neighborhood because of the university, but it's still a predominantly Black neighborhood. The food that we are cooking is food that I saw growing up. Right in my home. So we're cooking Southern American food. We are celebrating Black foodways, Black art, Black music. Mm-hmm. When you come into Virtue, you know, all the art on the walls is by Black artists who play some of the most beautiful music. I actually play the music myself, so I'm very proud of that.
Awesome.
But, you know, when we're looking at designing the menu, we're really looking at what's in season. So we look at the farmers around us and what they have available. We apply that through the lens of the past, pretty much. So what do we see growing up? What are techniques that are maybe not as used commonly or forgotten about? And we go from there.
Give me some examples.
So things like, let's see, I'm changing the menu very soon because obviously Chicago is telling us that fall is coming aggressively.
Oh, yes.
So my grandmother cooked a lot of rutabagas when I was growing up. Rutabaga, I think, is delicious, but it's just not a thing that I see on menus very often. Nichols Farms, they grow really amazing rutabagas that they will have very soon. I chose to marinate them in kind of a jerk spice situation. We're going to smoke them, and they will be served with sunflower seed pesto. Creamy farro and crispy sunchokes. And, you know, in my mind, this is just a rutabaga dish and sunflower seeds. And you have all these parts of the sunflowers, the sunchoke and the sunflower pesto, all those things are related to a sunflower seed. So I think that we take that approach to looking at ingredients that maybe aren't celebrated widely, that are considered humble. And then how do we use those ingredients nose to tail like we would a protein, right? So we're going to use the vegetable in all of its entirety. So that's the way I like to think about cooking in general.
That's interesting. I mean, you don't really hear a lot of discussion. You just described it as nose to tail, but you know, utilizing all of a plant. You don't really hear people talk about that. And you know, as we try to get closer to, you know, zero waste or trying to mitigate food waste in particular, I'm surprised that I certainly have not heard a lot of people talk about, you know, let's make sure that we're utilizing all of the vegetables. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I think it's really important. You know, I was just talking to Nick Nichols from Nick Farms, and I think I asked him pimento peppers like a year ago. And he just emailed me. He was like, "Hey, you still want pimento peppers?" I'm like, "Yeah, sure. How much you got?" He says he has 100 pounds of them. Now we're going to make, you know, gallons and gallons of pimento pepper hot sauce. But it's literally just a discussion of, okay, we're going to do this thing and see what we should be using with the farmer. So that's really how we like to cook.
That's a great approach. Now you've, it's my understanding that you didn't just grow up watching the Food Network. You also appeared on the Food Network, right?
Well, it was Bravo because it was Top Chef. But similar situation. It's something that I didn't ever see myself doing, but it was such an amazing experience, yes.
How'd that end up happening?
You know, honestly, so they reached out through Instagram, so I didn't think it was real at first.
Fair enough.
But I, you know, reached back out, heard what they had to say. I didn't really want to do it at first. But after talking to Chef Williams and some other people in the restaurant, they convinced me that was a good opportunity. And then we just kind of went from there.
What was that experience like? Had to be nerve-wracking. I would be nervous.
I'm a competitive person, but I never saw myself as, you know, like there are some serious chefs on Top Chef. I've actually been a fan of the show for years. And I would kind of look at those things and just be like, I couldn't do that, right? Like they're asking you to cook for 100 people in an hour. How do you do that? But, you know, I think that I learned so much about myself in the experience. I met so many wonderful people. And I thought what was also really great is I got to get really informed feedback, right? Mm-hmm. Like I think cooking in a restaurant as a chef, you have a lot of people who criticize, right? You have a lot of people who say they don't like a thing, but they can't tell you why they don't like it, right? Or they can't tell you that technically this isn't right. So to get feedback from someone like Chef Tom Colicchio, who can say, okay, this piece of pork that you braised is dry. Did you pull it out of the liquid when it was hot or when it was cold, right? And he's asking these questions based off of the fact that he knows that if you pull a hot piece of meat out of a braising liquid, that is going to dry out, right? That you have to cool it in the liquid. And he has informed feedback. So I think that that experience was just really informative. It was really exciting because it forced you to cook in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it was so good for my confidence and growth. And more all, it was just a ton of fun. Like it didn't feel like fun in the moment, but thinking back, it was so much fun.
I can definitely see that. I can relate to what you're saying. And it sounds like, you know, when I'm hearing you talk about this Top Chef experience and this informed feedback and you know, the approach that, you know, you now bring utilizing that feedback, it sounds a little bit like your experience growing up and having your mom and your family, you know, give you feedback to some of the things that you were doing in your sort of junior chopped in the house.
Yes. Yeah, I would say my mom wasn't as tough of a critic, but it definitely resembled that. I was so glad that I got the opportunity to do it, and it was an amazing experience.
That I can only imagine. I mean, you've had some unbelievable experiences, you know, obviously we're talking about James Beard Award winners, and you are one of them. How did you find out you were nominated?
Well, honestly, you know, I woke up one morning and my publicist, Laura, texted me, congratulations. And I was like, what are you talking about? and then I, you know, saw on Instagram that, you know, the semifinalist list came out and I read my name and I was like, wow. And it was just an amazing experience even to be a semifinalist on that list. You know, it's like 18 people on that list. And then they narrow it down to five. And once again, I think in the morning, my publicist Laura texted me, congratulations. And I was like, oh, okay. But it was a huge honor just to be named amongst those people.
Yeah, no question about it. So what kind of impact has that had on you professionally, you know, being part of a group that is, you know, so revered, you know, and it is an elite group. How has that, you know, impacted, you know, your business, people coming into Virtue, you know, even just maybe, you know, are you thinking differently about the menus that you create now because you have this moniker that says I'm a James Beard Award, you know, winner, and now I have a different responsibility.
You know, to be clear, I was raised in a fashion where we try not to let our highs get too high or our lows get too low. Mm-hmm. So when I was nominated, it was an honor. When I was sitting there, I was in my mind prepared to win and be grateful about that, and to not win and to cheer as loud as I could for whoever's name they called. So after the fact, we celebrated. It was a great time. And then we got back to work.
Yep.
There's a responsibility that came before James Beard, and I think the responsibility is the same. I think there are a group of people who look at those things and say, oh, well, this person has this accolade. Let's go to a restaurant because of that. And, you know, businesses need that. We can use all the help we can get. That's just the way of the business. But as far as my mindset, as I said, we celebrated and then it was back to work. I think I was washing dishes like 2 days after, right?
Yeah.
It's just the job. And I think if you get too hung up on those things, then you lose sight of what you're doing and why you're doing it. And also those events and those accolades are too few and far between for that to be the moniker or the motivator or why you choose to do what you do daily. So.
Amen. That is a great way to see things. And I, you know, frankly, I wish more people would have that view, that, you know, you're articulating here. You know, but speaking of responsibility and back a little bit to, you know, something that we covered earlier in our conversation about people of color in the kitchen, and, you know, you have worked with others, you know, chefs of color and owners and that sort of thing. Now, you know, you're in a position where, you know, you can mentor people coming up through the system, just as you were, you know, knocking on doors, working for free back in 2010. What are you doing, or what are you trying to do to, you know, help support the next generation of chefs that look like you?
Well, I think I was very fortunate to have strong mentorship early on through Chef Williams, and the things that he's done with me and taught me, we learn things so we can give them out. And I think that I'm probably doing it on a smaller scale right now, but right, he assisted me and talked me through purchasing my first home. Now I have conversations.
Wow.
Yeah. Like he did that for me. So I get to talk to people about budgets and how to save money and how to set up, you know, stocks and things like that, on a small level, right? So everything that he's given to me, I immediately try to give it to others that are around me. And I think even broader than that, the important piece of the whole visibility and notoriety is the fact that you get to be an example for someone else. Maybe someone who doesn't think they can do something gets to see, you know, themselves in you. Because I know seeing Chef Williams those years ago made things I dreamed about more tangible and made me believe that I could do it. So I think the more visibility on, you know, positive role models that look completely different or are doing completely different things, the better, right? Because it gives more space to others who, you know, could be the next emerging chef or whatever that thing is. So I try to start with my team who is around me and sharing whatever knowledge that I have and giving them space. And then I think about the fact that, you know, the responsibility is that you are being watched and you want to take that seriously. right? Because if people are following in your footsteps or they see you as an example, you don't want to lead them down the wrong path.
Absolutely. Well, I think that sometimes the things get boiled down in a way where, you know, it's like representation matters is a hashtag, but it's real. It's not just hashtag representation matters. I mean, you are articulating exactly why representation does matter, when people do see role models that they can relate to, it makes those dreams more tangible, as you just expressed. Obviously you're part of that landscape now too. Working on new things every day. I understand that there's, you got a couple other things going on with macaroni and cheese. Am I correct on this? Because I got to say, I will travel for macaroni and cheese.
So my aunt Inga, who she made the mac and cheese in my family growing up, for the special occasions. And it was something I really enjoyed. So once I became a professional cook, I started working on a recipe that made sense in a professional kitchen that I felt like tasted like home, but could be replicated, for a lot of people over and over again. And when we opened Virtue, that mac and cheese that I've been working on went on the menu. People responded really, really well to it. As we do all the time, Chef and I were kind of hanging out at the service one night. We had a couple of drinks and we were talking about mac and cheese for some reason, and the things we could do with it. And he does this a lot, actually. So, 2 weeks go by, I feel all about the conversation, and he's like, hey, what if we do this? We open this space, revolving around mac and cheese. And I'm like, okay, when do you want to do that? And he's like, next week.
Great.
So we already had the space in Mustard Seed. We knew we had two kitchens there. So we wanted to activate the other side of the building. And we turned that into Top This, where we use that same mac and cheese recipe and we put different toppings on it. And it's been a lot of fun so far. And the community has been responding really well. So it's been good.
And it's just takeout, right?
Yes, it is delivery and takeout only.
What are your toppings? Do you change them?
So far we have around 12 of them, but we have the classic, obviously. We have a teriyaki pork belly, buffalo fried shrimp, buffalo fried chicken. There's a blackened chicken. There's a vegetable one. There's all kinds of things on there. Yeah.
Well, I'm hungry now. So thanks. It seems like, you are always ready to take on a new challenge, whether it's, turning a mac and cheese operation on a dime, getting creative in how you're designing, new menu items. Where do you see yourself in the next 5 years?
I hope to open something small where I can continue my growth in food and continue my cooking. At Virtue, we're cooking for tons of people every night, which has been a beautiful experience. But I'm hoping to do something I wouldn't say on a smaller scale, but a little more intimate. I want to continue cooking food from my past. I do a ton of research on Black foodways and African diaspora, and I buy all these old cookbooks and just try to kind of cook through those recipes and see if I can make those relevant to today's foodways. So that's really what I see myself continuing to do.
That's fantastic. We need more of that kind of creativity. And, I am always interested in, learning about different food ways of different cultures, because it tells a very unique story. I mean, that's one of the things that drove me towards, using food as a way to capture culture and cultural storytelling. And it sounds like you're doing a similar type of thing, telling stories through your menu, and doing that research. It's all exciting stuff. Congratulations for all of your successes and, keeping your feet firmly planted on the ground, and, all the best to you, Chef Damar. Thank you for joining Eat Your Heartland Out. We look forward to seeing everything you continue to do.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Eat Your Heartland Out. This episode was produced by me, Capri Cafaro. Our audio engineers are Liam Warner and Armin Spengen. Theme music by Jason Shaw. Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.